is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790. We are your station for talking business. Well, the Dow Jones gained another 112 points today, closing at 20,950. The NASDAQ at 5,900, up 43 points. The S&P up 19 to 2385. Federal Reserve announcing another increase in interest rates today. So if you're thinking of buying a home or financing a car or anything where you have to borrow money, I'd say now's a better time to do it than 6 months from now. Also, a little heads up on anticipating two more rate increases by the end of the year. I shared many times with you all my view on this, and that as watching these cycles over the decades, it just seems to me that it's human nature to go too fast. It makes sense. There's a desire to solve the problem. We all would love to be a hero. We want to make everything better, and we think raising rates at a time like this is a good thing to do for our economy and for all of us in general. And so we have to go easy with it. And this is a quote from Don Sowa 20 years ago when he said that raising interest rates in an economy is like giving a child medicine. Too much medicine is as bad as none. And I agree completely. And I think announcing two more rate hikes by the end of the year is foolishness and going to cause more problems than it will. Unless they're just head-faking us, of course, trying to keep us on our toes. I don't think so. I do believe it's human nature to raise rates too fast. I think it's happened in every cycle that I've witnessed. And if we're going to raise rates four times in a year, I call that a fast pace, folks. A rate increase takes 6 to 9 months for you to be able to measure it or see it in the economy. So that to me is like, you know, if someone told me to give the child four tablespoons of something to help their cold, I wouldn't give them four. I'd give them one and watch them. I'd give them another one and watch them a little more. But I wouldn't just give them all four, you know, no matter what, and then measure it at the end of the four. I'd be monitoring it more closely than that. But it seems that rates will be rising throughout the year. What does that mean? It means time to borrow if you're going to. Of course, we discourage any unnecessary borrowing here on the Money Talk Show. But if you're going to borrow for any reason, and there are many good reasons to do that, buying a good quality property, that's tax deductible. Some people have to finance a car. If you're very young and you need a really good car for your work or stuff, we don't have cash to buy cars when we're very young. Most of us don't have cash to do it when we're very old. It's very difficult. So other than homes and automobiles, I try not to finance things if I can. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790. Wednesday night is Financial History Night on the program, and my son Nathan obviously is here again to join us to talk about, I guess, the 1990s markets in general, the environment.
Well, last week we talked about the 1970s and how there were some unique circumstances that were going on during that decade in our economy. Mainly, inflation was really high and interest rates were rising. So we're going to talk tonight about the 1990s, which were just as unique and crazy as a time, but for completely different reasons.
No 1980s. You hate disco like me?
I do hate disco. I do hate disco, but
I couldn't resist that.
But I think you know, actually the 80s were kind of a precursor to the 90s, except the technology boom really happened in the 90s, which really led to the dot-com boom, which we'll talk about, and the bubble that happened after that. And then if we have time later on, we'll talk more about some of my infamous bubbles that have happened over the over the eons of time. They go back, man. It's not a new phenomenon. A bubble can happen with any kind of commodity or asset, and it's happened 200, 300 years ago. There's records of it happening. So
it happens today also.
Yeah, but some people think we're in a bubble right now with certain things, whether it be the stock market, or what I hear all the time is student debt is a bubble that's going to burst, which is very complicated, and it does seem like it's gotten kind of out of hand. How much debt take on?
There was a very large group of people got it in their head that if you just got the degree, no matter what it costs, that you're guaranteed a great job.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
And the great jobs go to the same people every time, whether you're all educated or not. The hottest worker, most dependable, cooperative, respectful of authority, passionate about the mission of the company, that's who gets the promotions almost always.
And so many of the jobs nowadays are based on skills, and people who are older, who are more experienced, are going to have more skills, more refined skills. You know, if you go back 50, 60 years ago when jobs were more labor-intensive, of course you want a young man doing the job. He can go faster and lift things, you know, work more hours, but that's not how...
And not calling sick the next
day. That's not how the economy works anymore. Those jobs are not really as plentiful as they once were.
That's right.
And we have a skilled-based economy now. And older people are more skillful. That's just the way it is. They've
been around longer.
They've been around longer. They know how to do things more efficiently and quicker than younger people.
One of my favorite things to say to young people, I never said it to you because you always seem to have your head on really straight, but I was you once. You've never been me, right?
That's very true.
I think it's a good reason to listen to people that are old. It doesn't mean you do everything they say,
right?
But back to one of my favorite comments is that all advice is good, because you don't have to take any of it.
That's right.
That's a good, you know, humble way of approaching it. Hey, this is Steve and Nathan Bove on the Money Talk Show. We're here Wednesdays. I'm here on Fridays also. Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, of course, Don Sowa. And that was Don's quote about giving medicine to a child. And I think it's perfectly, again, on the dot.
He's got a couple of those good,
he's really good
analogies. So like the bull rider, right? How does that one go?
The president is a bull rider. He's hanging on for his life. He's not controlling the bull. He's not controlling the economy.
The bull is the economy, right? Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with that most of the time. You know, earnings and profitability of corporations is the only thing in the long run that will send the share price higher. Increased earnings, increased profitability. Nothing else does it in a permanent sense. It's the only thing that does it. Everything else is emotion and will usually be given back at some point in the future. We could be experiencing it right now in the U.S. stock market with the 12 or 13 point surge here since we had our new president, that if we don't get the tax reductions we were hearing about, there's some concern that that's already built in.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly,
I agree.
Clearly, he didn't even become president yet, and we saw this boom in the stock market. Right. So clearly, he hadn't done anything yet.
Right,
he wasn't
even
in the White House yet. So,
yeah.
And even now, he still hasn't done a lot of the things that he wants to do, because it takes a lot of time to do. But yeah, certainly the boom in the market that we've seen recently is due to anticipation of change, I would think, in the economy.
I think so. Yeah. Very much so. Keep in mind, the price of a stock in the open market is an auction environment. There is no fixed price of a stock, right?
No, it's changing all the time.
It's what the next person is willing to pay for it, just like your house.
That's right.
There's no fixed value for your house either. If no one wants to buy your house, what's it worth? Nothing, right? If you have a stock and no one wants to buy it, what's it worth to you at that moment? Nothing, because you can't turn it into cash. So that's why liquidity is very important. I had mentioned on a program, if you're considering changing your retirement accounts and you're older, like myself, meaning not 30s like Nathan, it's more important if you're older, I think, to keep your money liquid all the time. And the first reason is so that you can fire people if they don't take care of you right. I love that one. A lot of people don't like that comment in the financial business. They're afraid of being fired, I guess, right?
That's right.
I'm not afraid of being fired. Happens on occasion. But I'm not afraid of that at all. And so the best way one of the quickest, easiest ways of measuring is your account in a healthy way for you is ask the people that are handling the money, if I want to take the money out and put it all in the CDs tomorrow, what type of penalties will they be charged on the investments? Not taxes, just the investments themselves. And I think you'll find very soon we're going to have a country where everybody's retirement money will be liquid all the time, because when you stop commissions, you stop surrender penalties. This is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790. This is your station for talk and business. Hey, interest rates are going up. Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen announced quarter point rate increase today, and probably two more increases by the end of the year. That's going to be good for those of you who are CD owners. So a part of the group is going to be happy about that. Interest rates are a very funny thing. You know, high interest rates are great for the elderly because you can get great returns on your money without risk. But they're terrible for young people that need to borrow. because now you're paying, example, my first mortgage was 16% interest. I think it was actually 16.5%, believe it or not. So that's a tough thing to do. That actually worked out very well. I won't go into it. With the rental properties especially, when rates are very, very high and they fall, those properties tend to go up in value. That's what happened in the cycle in the 80s anyway. The term you heard this morning on the news was retail desert or something like that. Talk about a lot of the retailers are having a lot of trouble. Sales reports are coming in bad. I can't remember what the term they used. I'm
sure they weren't talking about dessert. Retail dessert?
No. Dessert, yeah, no. No, a desert meaning they think that where the malls are all standing now will be empty parking lots someday.
Oh,
as
yeah,
it gets
right.
Hotter and hotter for them to... The overhead to have a store in a mall is insane, the cost of the space.
Oh, yeah.
I never knew how any company could make a profit renting space in a mall. I never did it. I knew people that did do it.
Okay. Let alone now that you can buy all stuff online. And
you know.
Other world.
I mean, and the danger of a mall. Anytime people gather in groups today, there's a danger. You're not probably not afraid of that. You're young. I am. I'm old. You know?
No, you're right. You're right.
So I have no... If I never set foot in a mall again, that would be wonderful for Steve Bove. I love that one.
Yeah, it's funny. The only place you wanted to be when you were 16 years old, right?
Yeah, very cool. I agree. Very hip, yes. But anyway, so a lot of these retailers are in these malls. They are now. What's going to happen is a lot of debt there, and some of these there's going to be some bankruptcies here. And a lot of this debt is going to have to be washed away. It's probably going to aid to rising rates if that does happen. But the reason I brought it up was one of my themes, and you know, people at my age in my business, you know. 30, 40 years of experience. We all have these things that you call them pet peeves, you call them what you want. One of mine has always been, for 99% of you listening, I don't understand why you would invest in an individual company. I can understand it many years ago, but today there are tools available that are, I think, much a better choice. For example, if you had, if you were interested a few years ago in investing in retail and you were not invested in JCPenney, you know, a big name like that, that could turn out to be a very poor investment because of the macro trends that are changing in our society. This is big, big stuff that you're not going to change. It's on a course, and it's going to keep going that way. So as an example, I brought in a report for me from the Fidelity Select Retailing Portfolio. This is just this is what I recommended people do all my career if they thought retail was going to be hot. Was to not try to pick one company or one industry, but to invest in a mutual fund with people who are experts at one thing, retail stocks. And so a fund like this will have many, many different holdings, up to 30, 40, 50, up to 100. And the number one holding, you said this afternoon, was Amazon.
Yeah,
right?
It's Amazon. And I think, I bet you any money, if you rewind the clock 10, 15 years and looked at that fund, Amazon was in there. But it wasn't the number one holding.
Right. No, it wasn't. No.
But then as time went by and these fund managers who are experts in this category,
so that's right.
They can see this coming down the pipe and see that Amazon is going to be the new leader in this industry and gradually make Amazon the number one holding in the portfolio.
I have almost 40 years of experience in this business and I have no ability to do that.
Right.
See that in that one industry and know which companies to put. No way.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, these guys who are running these portfolios have an army of assistants
helpers
that, right. that are analyzing all these companies. And
however they get it done, it's amazing.
I mean, that's why you get those expense ratios in there. But this one, I think, had the one that we were looking at today, pretty low, I think. It was
0.81.
Yeah, under one, yeah.
Yeah, turnover rate 4%. Five-star rated fund, nice retail fund. Will tend to be the best time to own this kind of fund is coming off a bad economy. The market's been down real low.
Right.
You buy it, ride it up, you know. But anyway, the top holdings in this retail fund are Amazon, Home Depot, Priceline, Netflix, O'Reilly Automotive, TJX Companies. That's TJ Maxx. That's one of the ones.
Yeah,
probably might be in trouble. I don't know. AutoZone, Ross Stores, Dollar General, and Inc. That's 77% of the portfolio, those 10 companies. But the point is, you're not rolling the dice on just one. Not only that, the fund, over time, will adjust to how our world is changing. This is why I don't think individual stocks are. I think if you have large amounts of money, today I'm taking a stab at it. I might say, 10, 20, 30 million and up, like pension funds, should still be individual securities. There's enough money there to fully diversify, and individual stocks have what expense ratio?
Zero.
Zero, right. So I do think it's still the place for the large money, and that's all relative depending on who you're talking to. But the last portfolio that I took over, and I have a quite a pattern of doing this over time. I don't know if it's I've become a bit of a reputation for it or what. Of people who come in and have a statement, they show it to me. It's 42 pages long, and it just overwhelms them. And I asked them, would you like me to reduce that to 12 holdings? And they say, I will love you if you can do that. Please, please. So they can have some ability to understand it or comprehend it. Now, you don't do it all at once, and you, especially if you have unsheltered money, because you get buried with 1099s. It's a very careful process. But if you have too many holdings and you can't decipher them, now keep in mind also, Nathan, a person that has a portfolio like that might get a prospectus or a information on every one of those stocks in the mail.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing.
You know, yeah. I mean, I saw one was 41 pages long, the statement, a while ago. Matter of fact, you were in a trust account we took over last year.
Right, right, right.
That was one of the problems. Yeah. I just have no ability to understand what this is. Can it look like my 401k? That's what I tell them. Would you like it to look like your 401k plan? Almost everybody has had one of those.
Right.
Which means, you know, yeah, you got four or five funds. You may have quite a bit of holdings and in each of them. And I do think it's a better way of going about it.
Yeah. You could have like 9 or 10 funds in your portfolio, but the amount of the individual securities that are in those, I mean, you could have thousands.
My moderate model right now is about 10 ETF, individual stocks in there too. There's one individual stock. There's a closed-end fund.
Yeah.
There's ETFs, and occasionally you see a regular mutual fund in there. But the total holdings were about 4,500.
Wow.
So like 1,000 different bonds and 3,500 different stocks, and the client just gets to see 10 or 12 titles.
Right.
You know. So it's not always the best way to go. I think the more sophisticated you are, the more you're used to it, and or the larger the account, then the individual stocks go that way. Even if you want to play the dividend game today, there are so many. These ETFs are like ice cream. It's too many flavors, to be honest with you.
Yeah. You ever get to the ice cream store, you walk up there, and it's like, you're standing there for a half hour.
I'm ADD. I can't do it.
I can't figure out what vanilla.
I have to go in the car and take a nap and come back in. You know, yeah, I always, you owe me chocolate chip every time.
Right, chocolate chip, yeah.
But the number of them is still overwhelming, and, you know, it's a funny little analysis. But
and they're trying to pinpoint sometimes too small of a niche, and they can't generate enough funds to invest in,
and that's why those funds go out
and they have to fold. Yeah,
I've never had an ETF yet go out of business where I had to reallocate the money. I've had mutual funds do it
right
in my career, but never had it happen yet. An ETF,
well, if you pick something that's pretty broad like retail, I mean, that's not going to happen.
S&P 500.
Yeah, right.
It's the bizarre stuff.
Yeah, but if you're investing in an ETF that's investing in G.I. Joe figures, you know, that's not going to, right. It has a good chance of not generating enough interest,
and,
you know,
and they could close the fund, and after they close the fund, that area you were interested in could take off, and you won't be in it.
Right.
So I do think the obscure ETFs and the ones that are tiny in assets, this is why we try to keep, and it's not an exclusive concept, but we try to focus on the big carriers like BlackRock and iShares. Been around a while and have a good amount of assets in them.
Then there's the whole breed of ETFs that are out there nowadays, these leveraged ones that can be very dangerous and risky if you don't know what you're doing.
So dangerous that we are not allowed in our office to use them with
clients.
Right,
that's right. Yeah.
That's a rule in our office.
Yeah. So that basically means that
they can lose money so fast and make money so fast and make your head spin.
Right. So it'll pick an index, and it usually their history will say if you pick a three times ETF, you'll see that, or a bull ETF. Means that it's anticipating doing three times whatever the index it is it's following. And then they had the three times bear index, which is like a reverse of the index. If the index goes down 10%, you're going to go up 30%. I mean, right. it's complicated. And
most people are going to end badly.
Most people are going to end badly.
Most of the time. Yeah. If you're very sophisticated, yes, if you do buy one of these, if you buy any mutual fund that has two times or three times in the name, that's something you've got to watch every day almost.
Right.
You can't buy that and forget about that. Hey, it's a topic that comes up an awful lot. I'm going to throw a teaser at you before the break here. What should you do? Should you, if you want to retire at 62, should you apply for your Social Security benefit or use your assets and let your Social Security benefit get bigger? When I return from the break, we'll have a quick discussion on that and then right into our Financial History Night on the Money Talk Show. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show with Steve Bove and Nathan Bove on Wednesday evenings. Nathan's our financial history expert here in the program. Prior to the break, however, I did give you a little bit of a plug, and this is just my opinion. This can be debated either way, depending on your circumstances, although I do feel pretty strongly about this one. You want to retire at 62. Do you apply for Social Security, or do you use your assets and let Social Security grow? Now, Social Security grows at that point from 62 to 70 at a pretty high rate, something like almost 8% the benefit goes up by. Number one, I don't have a lot of faith in the Social Security system. I think it's going to falter, so I don't believe that the numbers. I see the numbers they tell me I'm going to receive is at my retirement. I shave a whole $1,000 a month off, 20%, right, Nathan?
That would be 20% for you?
For me, it's about $4,000, Mom and I together. Yep. So in my financial plan, I take $1,000 off. Nathan and I, when we're doing financial plans with people, when they give us their Social Security report, whatever the Social Security system tells you you're going to get, we take 20% off just in case it falters. I think there's a pretty good chance it will.
Depends on how young you are, too. I mean, we did one today for a couple that was in their early 40s. Yeah,
they were young.
It was even more. It was 33% I took off.
You took off a whole third. Yeah. More time for more to go wrong.
Exactly.
Now, what happens if you're wrong, son, and nothing goes wrong?
Well, then the situation is just a little bit more rosy than we thought it was, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's the right approach, because if you're completely wrong on this, the client will end up in a much richer economic
place. Well, it's the famous saying, you plan for the worst and hope for the best.
There you go. Here's another way I think you can relate to it. If you were to use your assets, your IRA, 401k, money savings, and let that Social Security benefit grow, let's say from 62 to 70, 8 years. 8 years, you can chew through a lot of money, a lot of capital, taking it out of your account, living on it, right? And then you're going to now switch over to the new super-duper charged-up Social Security benefit, and 6 months before you turn 70, it's in the news that the system is bankrupt. It's been tapped into and abused again by our government. Money's been used for other things, and that you'll be getting a 30% reduction, or it's going to be means-tested, or whatever your income is, and then that gets knocked backwards. I really believe there's a high risk of that happening. So I believe, and what I'll be doing, is collecting my Social Security benefit as long as I can collect the full benefit, which means if at 62 I'm going to make $70,000 a year, no. But we're talking about retiring at 62. Retiring means not working, most of the time anyway. So I think that if I was to, if I collect my Social Security benefit at 62 and at 69 it falters, I have all those assets to lean back on. Where if you use the assets waiting for Social Security and it falters, the assets aren't there anymore.
Well, it's the adage that you pound the table on all the time, baby. Nothing's guaranteed. So if that's your belief, then
if it's not guaranteed, I want to take it as fast as I can get my hands on
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Because keep in mind, folks, that Social Security benefits don't have estate benefits. Paid into this thing an awful lot. I've been self-employed my whole life. I paid in about double into Social Security what I would have had I been a W-2 employee. But about the same went into my portfolio at Social Security as yours, because you had if you're an employee, you have a company match. It's about 7% a piece, give or take a little bit, you know. So, you know, 15% of my income for the last 25 years is a lot of money. And if my wife and I were to be killed in a car accident tomorrow morning, it all disappears. And my fine children wouldn't see one penny from that money I paid in. So anytime you have a benefit that has no estate value, it is my personal opinion only, to get my hands on it. In the office, I do the Jerry Maguire thing. You've heard me do that, right? Show me the money.
That's right.
That's how I explain it. Now, I tell them, if you have more faith in me in the Social Security system, and you're not concerned at all about the stability of that system, then possibly my way isn't the best way for you. But I find it hard to believe that anyone would have faith that the Social Security system will not falter. Now, I don't believe it's going to disappear. I don't believe for 1 minute you'll pay into it all your life and get nothing from it. I don't believe that at all. But I do believe there's a high potential for not just problems, but for means testing. Who knows what happens in 20 years from now? And if you have over a certain income, it may get means tested back away from you again. So my opinion is, and I think if you're a person facing this decision, you should hear a variety of opinions, because I think they all have some valor. I'm a bit of a skeptic. I don't trust any government handling money ever. Ever. I don't care if it's a town. They're not financial people. And the financial people they hire oftentimes aren't good choices either. So I like financial companies handling finance. I like insurances, insurance companies selling insurance, not investment people. And I think governments should govern. Now, Nathan, let's get to financial history night. We're talking about the decade of the 90s,
right?
Which was some pretty good, darn good returns.
Yeah, we saw S&P did about 15.5% a year on average during that decade. The only other decade that was comparable The 80s were pretty close, but the 20s saw similar returns on average a year. And one thing you'll notice that the decade following the 20s and the decade following the 90s were not very good. No. 1930s, of course, the Great Depression, and the 2000s, pretty much a flat market that year. If you invested in just the S&P 500 in 2000, by 2010, you didn't have really much anything to show for it.
It seems that the long term, I mean, you know, 60-year average of stocks is about 8%, and the long term of CDs is about 4%, about double.
Right.
And anytime you get a disjointing of that math, you pay for it somehow later on.
So the big characteristic of the 90s was the dot-com boom, or bubble, as you would say. And, you know, bubbles can take many shapes and sizes and flavors. But one of the big things that happens in every bubble is that there's this investors get enamored with this new paradigm or innovation. And with the dot-com bubble, it was pretty obvious that it was the internet and new companies that were coming on board in this time period. And, you know, there were so many companies that were jump-starting and going public, and there was such an appetite for people to invest in these companies that companies didn't care about the numbers, the profitability.
The fundamentals
just were, like, out the window. And really, all they cared about was brand recognition and market share,
and a feeling, am I missing out?
Right.
The driving force.
But I think there was by the late 90s, there was a sense that the companies knew that this was not going to last forever, and they thought, if we can just get a market share, when the dust settles, we'll be the only ones left standing. And there were companies like Amazon took this philosophy. We know Amazon's around today, right? eBay, same thing. They did not turn profits for years in the 90s, but all they cared about was market share, brand recognition, and it paid off because
when the smoke cleared, who's standing?
They were the ones that were standing because people knew their names. But there were famous companies that tried that and didn't succeed. You know, like Pets.com was one of the most famous ones because they were featured in a lot of Super Bowl commercials. Oh. They had the sock puppet that was a dog that talked, you know, and the company lost $147 million in the first 9 months of 2000. The company was unable to secure more cash.
Maybe they were just early on the pet craze. It seems to be working very well now, the pet craze.
Yeah, I think Americans have always been crazy about their pets.
A lot of spending. It's amazing how much money is spent on pets.
And then pet insurance. It's just, I don't get it.
We're not pet people, you and I.
We're not, but we love people who are very much pet people.
Of course. So. We have, my best buddy's a pet guy.
Yeah.
He sleeps with his dog.
Right.
I don't get it.
Some companies actually
not going to get it.
Some companies actually raise their stock price just by putting a .com at the end of their name. Or an E in front of their name. They existed for 10 years, and they just threw a .com, and they saw their stock share increase.
Perception.
Prefixed investing. That's what was called. Investors were just looking for stocks that had these prefixes or suffix after the names.
Right, right.
But like I said, you know, they were concerned with the market share, and growth over profits was the theme that we saw. One of my favorite stats comes from the Super Bowl commercials, right? In the 2000 Super Bowl, there featured 16 dot-com companies. Each paid about $2 million for a 30-second ad. The following year, in 2001, the Super Bowl featured just 3 dot-com companies. That kind of gives you an idea of how drastic the change was there. Cities and states created favorable environments for dot-com industries. For example, there was this place in Virginia that the state paid for this brand-new building to be built that was equipped with high-tech fiber optics to accommodate these technology companies and encourage them to come to their state. And within 2 years, it was a parking lot, a ghost town, you know, because these companies had just all went bankrupt.
It's all about earnings.
That's right. In the long run, that's all it's about is earnings.
That's all it's about.
I mean, the P.E. ratio has just got insane. It was so high. By 2004, nearly 50% of the dot-coms ceased to exist that existed before 2004. The S&P had a high in March of 2000 of 1,572 and a low in October of 2002 of 776. That's an overall decline of 49% over 31 months. And but 5 years prior to the burst of the bubble, it was 20% a year for 5 years. And then 5 years after that, it was just negative for 5 years, negative 4.75%. But you were in the business. You had just started the radio show in the 90s.
Early 90s,
I mean,
yep.
You must have stories of clients saying, hey, we got to invest in some .com
sure.
stocks, you know, and
yep.
I'm sure the answer then was the same as it is now.
Exactly the same. No, but, you know, most of them, having a show like this is really quite fascinating in that when people get to listen to you, and we have people come in our office, you know this now, you've been around long
yep.
enough. They come in sometimes and say, I've been looking forward to becoming a client for 10 years. I didn't need you till now. Maybe their 401k plan was their main asset.
Sure.
They didn't have any other. That's pretty common, you know, in New England. And they get to listen for a long time. So what happens is, if you're in the financial business and you're sending out cold letters and cold calling, and that's how you meet people, you get a variety of people because you're bumping into them that way. But when people get to listen to you for 10 years first and then call you, they call you, we don't call them, the only ones that call you are the ones that agree with how you think. Does that make sense?
That's why they're calling you.
Yeah. There's something about your style that they say is similar or I'm comfortable with that. So you end up with a lot of people of similar ilk thinking.
Right.
So occasionally I did a 401k rollover a year ago with someone who had individual stocks of a company that he worked for all his life. He loved it. I think it was GE. When he did the rollover, he said to me, now I've been listening to you for 10 years. I know you don't want to have any individual stocks. He said, but I got to ask you, could I keep just 5% of my portfolio in GE stock? And I said, yes. But it's got to be a stock like
that. It's reasonable. And it's a reliable stock that pays a good dividend.
And you're well aware of it. That's
right,
what I'm saying.
Yeah,
so
right.
You don't want to be carte blanche on it completely. But if that client had said to me, I want all individual stocks, I wouldn't even take the account over.
Right.
I would say to him that I don't think that's the best way to do it. And if you do want to do it that way, I'm not highly skilled in that area. So you want to find someone who is highly skilled and very experienced, has a lot of clients like that already, the way you want to do it. And that's the best way to match up with an advisor, someone who has got great experience at doing it the way you think it should be done.
Right. If you're looking to give orders, you don't need it. You don't want to find an advisor. You want like a stockbroker.
Yeah, we'll call them suggestions.
Yeah, right. So one of the things I really want to do for talking about the dot-com bubble of the 90s was think about what were some of the companies that survived. You know, what, like, for example, Amazon, obviously we know survived. You know, what did Amazon experience during that bubble? And Amazon's initial public offering took place in May of 1997. And they started off at $18 per share, and it rose to more than $100 per share. But then after the bubble burst, it was down to $10 a share. So even a company like Amazon, you know, I don't know how you could tell at that time that Amazon was going to last. I mean, you look at those numbers.
Right.
You know, it went from $100 to $10
right.
in a year.
If you had the insight, and I surely didn't, because, again, individual stocks I don't do much with, but somebody somewhere said Amazon's model is the best for modern retailing, and the person that saw that and believed that would be the one that saw it coming.
Right. But there were other companies that had similar model.
Yeah,
and Amazon wasn't the retail giant that it is today.
They were
specifically books.
Right.
Their company eventually started as a book retailer.
That's correct. Hey, here are some failed tech companies of the past. Atari, Hitachi, America Online, Compaq, Palm, right?
Oh, Palm Pilot.
Palm Pilot.
Yeah. I had a phone, a Palm Palm Pilot phone for a long time.
Yeah. They're all Palm Pilots now. They all fit in your hand, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
But those are big names, and those are companies that went out of business.
Right.
And what people don't understand is if that a stock like that gets a negative reputation, negative connotation, starts falling, you can put an order in to sell it all day. If nobody wants to buy it, the trade's not going to go off.
Right.
And you're going to ride it all the way down to the basement. Individual stocks are very dangerous, folks. Please use them selectively. This is the Money Talk Show with Nathan and Stephen Bovay tonight, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790, your station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. Financial History Night on the program. We're talking about the 90s decade in general And a little bit about some of the bubbles that occur. Seemingly every decade we get a few of those.
Every century.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, the gold, crazy, to me, was the last one.
That was a big one that happened, you know, in 2000.
Yeah.
Gold, August of 2001, 272 an ounce. By September of 2011, it was 1,800 an ounce.
It went up like crazy. Right after the Katrina, is it the Katrina hurricane?
Yeah.
Right after that, it went just crazy.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting fact. The last 5 years, if you had a gold investment, it's minus 30%. That's the five-year return. That's pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to have really took off after the 2008 financial debacle, which I guess makes sense. You know, I mean, it's a haven from...
But we had never seen gold do that in other debacles before. It was unique to that particular...
Well...
1981 is the only time I remember it surging.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I'm a chart freak. I studied these charts. So there have been many other bad economies between 1981 and now, and I don't remember gold going up like that.
You're right. If you look at a chart of gold... You're right.
I just have fun with it.
You're right.
If you look
at a chart of gold, you know, for the last 100 years, there's two obvious high points, two peaks.
And, 81.
And one is 80.
High inflation.
Yep. And the other one is 2011. That we saw that peak there. But, you know, bubbles are funny. They you can read about them and hear and learn about them all through history, not just in modern times.
Yep. And goes one back of my, to the 15th century.
It was
tulips.
Tulips were probably the most famous first bubble that you read about. Mm. But for some reason, tulips got really expensive in the Netherlands back then. And I think the data, it's kind of taken on a bit of a folklore. I think it's pretty obvious that there was some kind of mania surrounding tulips. But, I mean, some of the reports were
How accurate is hard to know.
Some of the reports were like, it was three times the average, the yearly salary for an average worker for one tulip bulb.
Right.
You know, it's just like, that is, it's possible. Anything's possible. But
I think it might have something to do with a disease that hit them, and they thought they were going to become extinct, tulips. And if you could garnish that last little supply, they'd be worth a fortune globally.
I don't know.
Something crazy.
Something crazy like that. But, yeah, so that's one of the first ones that you hear about.
Well, what they all have in common is that they're all, the psychology going into them is to get rich quick.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And my favorite one is the South Sea Bubble in Britain, which was the same exact situation as the get rich quick. The British government set up a joint stock company in 1711 to explore the Americas, because the Americas had just been colonized and they were going to do trade. The government was giving this company an exclusive trade monopoly with the Americas. But the problem was all the trading routes and all the colonies that they were going to be trading with were owned by the Spanish. And England and Spain did not get along at all at this time. They were actually at war. So the company never made any money, and they just inflated the stock price. The most sinister thing that happened, and this is really the first evidence of really widespread market manipulation, was that this time, again, this is like the early mid to 1700s, was that the government was letting people exchange debt. So if you had debt, owned government debt, you could exchange it for shares in the company. And the government was all for this, because the debt was guaranteed, and they had to pay you.
Right.
But if you exchange it for stock, the stock can go up and down in value.
Right.
And it went up, 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 and more people were going in and exchanging their debt that they owned for shares in the stock. And over a 2 month period, the stock price plummeted. You know, from $1,000 a share to £1,000 a share, of course in England, but down to almost nothing in a 2 month period. Now, that's one of my favorite ones, but there's so many you can talk about. The Japanese asset bubble that happened in the 80s is another famous one. There's too many to count, to be honest with you. But when we have more time on another night, we'll go deeper into some
of these. Message from Nathan and Stephen tonight about bubbles in general is that when anything in the investment world that you suddenly realize is the craze, everywhere you go, that's all people are talking about, be very, very careful. And if you go into those waters, wade in ankle deep, don't dive, right?
Right, right.
Monitor it, be careful, and don't dive in, because these things, these type of bubbles are followed by whatever the opposite of a bubble is, a burst,
a
right?
A burst, yeah.
Generally speaking. Nate, thanks again for your participation on the program, and tune in tomorrow night for Don Sower right here on AM 790, your station for talk and business.
You're what I say. Money that matters. faith. All of these people are much brighter than I. In any fair system, they would flourish and thrive, but they barely survive.